From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells.
Well, hey, John. Remember the days of, you know, skinny skis and carbo-loading, those neon bright colors on a one-piece ski suit?
I remember being skinny.
And then there was freestyle ballet skiing and, you know, John Denver, Rocky Mountain High. Well, these are the days in which our guest Tiger Shaw competed as an Olympic alpine skier. Tiger competed at the Sarajevo and Calgary Winter Games. He skied at Dartmouth. He was on the World Cup circuit. He skied that famed Hahnenkamm in Austria. And actually, his best World Cup finish was here in Park City in 1985. Fast forward a handful of decades, and Tiger Shaw is both a local Parkite and CEO of the U.S. Ski and Snowboard. He's joining us on Cool Science Radio to tell us how the science and technology of skiing and snowboarding has changed over the decades. Tiger Shaw, welcome to Cool Science Radio. Great to have you.
Good morning, Lynn and Tron. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's been pretty fun, I would imagine, for you going from, you know, growing up, your whole family into ski racing. Now you have three kids of your own who have also skied at these Eastern schools, Middlebury and Dartmouth. And you've also been a professional in the industry. And to see how it evolves over time, we know that sports evolve with technology, but they also evolve with creativity, which I think that that's really been present in the skiing and snowboarding world.
It has been. Things obviously have changed a lot since the mid-80s, and technology plays a larger and larger role. There is both a mix of science and pure art in the way things are done, depending on which aspect of which sport you're talking about. But I still remain amazed at the number of variables that go into any one of these events, being outdoor sports on snow, sliding across it, and at times at very high speeds.
It's funny if any of us think about, you know, our histories with skiing. I mean, I know that you, like I, started skiing on wooden skis. I don't even remember if my alpine skis had metal edges or not. I guess they probably did. And then on up to that big evolution of the ski with the shaped ski, or I guess we called them parabolic back in the day, to what they are now. They're so much wider. Can you take us through that sort of the look at, you know, how it used to be when you were racing on those skis we would call archaic now?
No, exactly. Well, the way I like to put it is, you know, back in that era when I was racing, it took 20 years to learn how to carve a turn efficiently. So no sliding, just on a rail.
Right.
And now all you do is roll the ski up on edge, and literally almost anybody can carve a turn. So the game has changed from figuring out how to get the ski to do what you want it to do to a ski that will do anything you want it to do, and how to control it carefully and safely, because the dynamic aspect of the turns that they are capable of making is amplitudes higher than it was in the 80s.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Tiger Shaw. He competed in the 84 Winter Olympic Games in Sarajevo and the 88 Games in Calgary. He's currently the president and CEO of the United States Ski and Snowboard. Well, Tiger, as you and I know all too well, most mid to high handicap golfers have trouble hitting the golf ball straight. Now, most of us slice, you know, right-handed golfer that bends the ball to the right. So companies like Golf Tech have shown up that hook customers up to sensors that provide all sorts of numerical and video feedback to help them understand what they're doing wrong and what they can do to improve. What kind of technologies are used in your business to help provide feedback to our elite racers?
Well, with the advent of GPS too and force sensors, there has been a ton of headway that's been made in these areas. So if you think about a downhill race where much like a car race, there's a lot of latitude as to the line or where you go down the course. Slalom and giant slalom, you pretty much go around the next gate, which is right in front of you. But downhill, you have a lot of planning to do, a lot of forces, and, you know, there might be, you know, hundreds of meters that a turn takes. And so there's lots of different judgment lines. So we use systems now that track your exact position on the course as you go down the course, using GPS sensors and force sensors that tell us where the highest force is within the turn. And then to the degree we can overlay video from all of our competitors from a race, we try to understand how the fastest person was the fastest and study both the video, the force, the actual line using overlays. So you've got a ghost on top of somebody skiing down the course so you can see if you're ahead or behind that person. This technology has been critical to be able to dissect what the very best way is to get down the course. If you are capable of getting down the course in that way, which of course takes tremendous strength, ski preparation, and planning. So, I mean, the number of variables is huge.
So if you were competing, if you had a team competing in a race, and first up on the American side was, say, the 10th person that was going to be taking this giant slalom course, you'll be able to get almost real-time information so you can get data to that person before he or she starts?
Yeah, it's actually in two phases. So when you're watching it live, there's a limitation on how much actual data versus viewing that you can do. And then the data is collected later with the split times when we're able to use these sensors on our athletes. Sometimes it's in training of a downhill course, not the actual race. But there is, and this is where the art comes in, you have everybody who's competing in the event watching the others compete on TV at the World Cup level because their TV is in the start. And so they're seeing, did Jansrud, you know, did he go down the course and did he take the high, the middle, or the low line exiting the Hausberg, for instance? And so these are all factors that they use. And then they decide, they kind of put it all together into what their plan is. They get in the start and they punch it down the course.
It's interesting that you're talking about this, Tiger, because you're making me think about sort of the layperson or the average skier who watches a World Cup race televised, and it's dawning on me how much even we could learn by watching, you know, that overlay of, you know, the previous skier versus the current skier and the line that they're taking. You know, it never occurred to me that that could be changing our own skiing just as viewers. But this takes me into something I know you're interested in, is harnessing virtual reality. How is, or how do you project VR kind of helping you in this world?
Well, it's a big deal, and it's evolving quickly, both from the standpoint of doing 360-degree point-of-view videos of a course. So we actually did this with the Pyeongchang downhill, the Olympic course in 2018, and then we put it into a video system, and then we have the ski simulator in the USANA Center of Excellence in Park City that is the closest thing to simulating actual skiing that I know of. And we combine the VR of the video with the physical aspect. You can move laterally on this platform. It has motors and cables, and you wear ski boots and get into a tuck. And so you actually kind of run the course. So you're doing two things. One, you're physically playing around with that line judgment that I was just talking about to see how that works. And then at the same time, you're mentally rehearsing the course. So if you have a two and a half mile, it's almost 3 mile course in Bengen, Switzerland, and you've got to make judgments all the way down. And so if you come around a corner and you're confused which part of the course you're on, that's not very good. In other words, you have to memorize the course, know what you want to do, and execute. So there's this huge inventory of data you've got to have in your head. So rehearsing that without actually skiing the course, which you only get to do two or three times a year, is really important. So that mental rehearsal builds those pathways within your brain that make it automatic. And, you know, to a golfer, the parallel there is where you're just sort of marching around the course, hardly thinking about what you're doing and having the round of your life, primarily because it's automatic and you've practiced it. And as soon as you start thinking about what you're doing, then you start choking, essentially, and you over-engineering what you're trying to do, whether it's a swing or a ski turn. So that's why practice is so important, and it's a big deal. Mental rehearsal is a big, big deal.
Oh, I'm glad you've given me the term mental rehearsal. As my kids were growing up and ski racing, I always talked about muscle memory to the extent that they said, would you please stop saying muscle memory, Mom? So mental rehearsal, I think I'll adapt that. So, you know, it leads me to a question about the Center of Excellence. I know that, or I think from what I've read, that when the Center of Excellence was first built out at Quinn's Junction back in, I think, was it 2009 or somewhere around there? Mm-hmm. It had all the bells and whistles. But how long does it take, you know, the average athlete who has just grown up doing the sport, loving the sport, to kind of adapt to the bells and whistles and all this technology? I mean, at the end of the day, even if some racer knows how Michaela Schifrin makes, you know, makes a turn, they might not be able to do it ever because she's one of a kind.
Well, really what Michaela's secret is her work ethic and her the amount of repetition she did as a young child. And so, you know, many of our ski and ride sports really depend on a tremendous amount of practice at a young age, doing exactly what you just said, which is those neuromuscular pathways. So when you practice in high volume in a deliberate way, it's called deliberate practice, where you execute your sport, whatever the sport is, in this case, maybe a ski run or an aerial trick, and you have experts watching you and the overlays of technology, video, metrics, et cetera. And then you analyze how that iteration went, and then you go back up and you do it again, and you make tiny adjustments every single time. That's as opposed to just simply repeating your sport without really thinking much about what you're doing. So your chance to improve and to build those neuromuscular pathways is while you're practicing over all those years and tons of repetition, so that when it's time to execute, aka compete, you don't have to think. It's automatic. You are programmed. And in fact, if you do think too much about what you're doing, your brain gets in the way because your body is reacting. It's really a spinal reflex because of these nervous pathways you've built as you navigate your way through your sport. And if you're thinking about it, then all of a sudden that nervous pathway and that reaction goes into your brain and out. And that delays things by milliseconds, which are critical. And it may feel good, but actually it could be much worse. And the irony of this is, and I remember this well from the 80s when I was competing, the very best runs I ever had, I do not remember. I just don't remember. They just happened.
Oh, that's just fascinating.
And that's a feeling as a world-class athlete when you get to that point where you can execute, and then you almost have to look back at video to remember what happened. That's a level of achievement. And body composition and training, that is what's it take. That's what it takes.
When virtual reality first came out of the game, you know, broke away from the game world into, you know, other types of applications, like the application you spoke about with mental rehearsal. In 2014, the guy that started the virtual human interaction lab at Stanford University was curious if he could help a quarterback be more productive in practice. And so he put together this thing of, you know, 350-pound linemen coming at him. And he could take snaps in his bedroom at night, because there's only so many snaps you can take in practice. And it's the same thing, I'm sure, in skiing and in snowboarding. The quarterback back in 2014, Kevin Hogan from Stanford, was able to take snaps in his pajamas every night. And this really helped to prepare him. Are your racers able to do this at home?
Yes. No, they do it constantly. And it may be recalling, they may be doing it aided by video where they're watching a run or a race that they've been in or a competition. And then you just sort of slow down, close your eyes, and then mentally repeat the run. And if you had an error in the run, then you mentally repeat it over and over again until you've blanked that out and you've properly executed the part that you didn't the time before. And there are a lot of studies that show that can be incredibly effective. You can't do it without the physical practicing aspect, but you also can't do it well if you're not good at mentally adapting and adjusting and learning in that manner too.
And can they overlay that virtual reality learning with a certain type of music or a certain type of affirmation in the background or something that would help them get to that relaxed point that you talk about?
Yes, that's a good point. A lot of our athletes do use music in multiple ways. So the older sports, let's say cross country or alpine or even freestyle, maybe it's a little more how to relax and how to get themselves into what's known as the zone, where you've really sort of blocked all the external aspects of your environment out of your consciousness, and you're really focused on what you want to focus on. That's getting ready to compete. But then snowboard and free skiers very often are playing music as they compete. So it's more like figure skating and in the aspect where it's almost choreographed to a certain degree, but they utilize it in a proactive way. Where, for instance, an alpine racer would use it as a way to react, and they are not wearing an earphone on the way down the course in alpine, but they are in snowboard and free ski. So that's very different.
Yeah, so just thinking about anyone who watches a free ski competition or snowboard in the super pipe, or anytime we watch aerials, you know, when the World Cup's here at Deer Valley, you always wonder, how about the first time they added on another 360 or another twist or whatever it is? How is it for them in terms of breaking down the trick so that you can perfect it before you even attempted it?
Well, a lot of times when you're watching somebody do a complex trick on snow and a half pipe or slope style or a big air, you don't really know that they've been practicing that for months. They may have developed it during the summer, into a pool, into an airbag, on a trampoline. There's an entire progression they go through. And then they work their way into performing it actually on the field of play. So say a super pipe, you know, 12, 15 feet above the lip. So when you typically, unless you're coaching them with them all the time, but when you first see it as a spectator, it may seem like they just kind of pulled that off, but there's just a tremendous amount of work that has gone into learning how to do that safely. Because as you can see, when you throw yourself into that kind of amplitude above a pipe and you need to come down right on the knife edge of the wall properly to land, it's dramatic. And so they don't just pull it off that day. It's a lot of work to get to that point.
Oh, absolutely. Well, let's move on to things like diet for an athlete. You know, we interview a lot of athletes, and oftentimes we ask them what their, you know, dietary habits are for training. And a lot of times we hear that it's stuff that just tastes good at the time, you know, whether it's a cookies or a Coke or a ham sandwich or whatever it is. But, you know, back in the days in the 80s when you were competing, that was about carbo loading, and you know, you'd eat like 10 bagels a day and then a lot of fake food that was low fat, because you know, if you're going to be an athlete, all carbs, no fat. And that's very different now. Can you talk about that evolution?
Yes, Lynn, it's changed considerably, as you know, and we have on staff nutritionists, sports nutritionists that are experts in this, and it's an evolving field constantly. But in the 80s, you're right, we didn't really understand the importance of, for instance, the right amount of protein in your diet and what time of day that protein intake. And then also that coordinated with your training schedule. So, for instance, it's very important after a very tough endurance workout to get protein in your body within 20 or 30 minutes when you complete working out. And so there's all kinds of science and studies and better understanding. So the difference between simple and complex carbohydrates and sugar in your diet, and also keeping your energy level and timing that energy level for training and for competition. Because the last thing you want to do, and this is a typical scenario where sometimes a downhill racer, we call that sport hurry up and wait. So you hurry up, get started, get organized, get up to the start, you're ready to go, and there's a course delay because of weather or something. So you may think you're going to compete at 10 a.m. and you compete all of a sudden at 12:30 p.m. And that's normally when you're expecting to eat lunch. So supplemental snacks and food at that time, and also having the right supplements. So USANA is a major partner of ours, and we do a lot of work and research with them. And it is really critical. All the same time, you have to be very much a policeman of what you put in your body, because you could inadvertently put one of the banned one of the chemicals or one of the nutrients that are banned on the anti-doping list. So you have to be really careful, and we have to constantly screen all that. But the best thing about what our nutritionists do, and we do, we serve usually not this year in COVID, but we normally would serve breakfast and lunch in the COE when people are training there, Center of Excellence. And they are also learning from a nutritionist who they're being fed by them. At the same time, they're teaching them, what's important, how to cook. Because the last thing we want to do is have our athletes eating properly at the Center of Excellence and then going home that night buying pizza.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, thanks for joining us. We're speaking with Tiger Shaw at Park City Local and President and CEO of the United States Ski and Snowboard. Tiger, I wanted to talk to you about snow injection. And for our listeners, I understand this is a process of forcing water 1 to 2 feet into the snow through tiny nozzles from a high-pressured hose. It's used to make race courses more consistent and weather-resistant, trying to keep things on a level playing field, I guess is the way to describe it. Now, they weren't doing this in 1984, but they're doing it now. They've been doing it for a while, I guess maybe 10, 15 years. And Lindsey Vonn once likened it to skiing on pond ice. So a few questions. One is it controversial? And two, has it affected the equipment being used or the way our elite athletes train?
Yeah, it's changed everything. Back in the 80s, they used to shovel the extra snow out of the woods and then spray the hill with a fire hose, which wasn't very scientific, but it certainly made it hard then also. But the idea with injection is that you're adding a ton of moisture to the snow when it's below freezing, so it freezes as you inject it. And it does make for the skating rink. And the idea is that when it's that firm, we call that a good surface in alpine, it means that it doesn't deteriorate when you have 60, 70, 80 people go over it, because it's hard as concrete. Now, skiing on that is a completely different game than anything you've ever experienced. There is no such thing as the same feel as injected ice that you find in nature. So you can ski in the east after a rainstorm when it freezes and you think that's icy. That's actually no comparison. But the athletes love it. But you have to learn how to adapt to it, which for an American is tough, because most of that is in Europe. Although we do inject, we're here at Copper Mountain, Colorado right now, and we do inject the snow here for training and for practice purposes. And the skis have gotten, as you know, we were just talking about, they have greater side cut. We put more acute angle into the edges, so it's not a 90-degree steel edge. Sometimes it's an 87-degree steel edge. And there are rotary grinding machines now that make that edge as sharp as any knife you would find in any restaurant in Park City. And that can also be dangerous. And if the snow, if it warms up, then all of a sudden it's grippier and you need to detune the ski. In other words, use sandpaper or a gummy stone to make it a little less sharp. And it's an endless game, but it is shocking if you go into a ski room at a World Cup race and see what they're doing with the equipment these days. It's to get ready for that ice fall that they have to race on.
My first day of skiing was not pretty, I can tell you that. I forget how long ago it was, but my friends, really responsible friends, took me to the top of Wildcat on the north face, and they said, just make a couple of turns, good luck. And so there was a sheet of ice that I hit that was very thick, that may have been the size of Rhode Island. It may not have been that big, but it was, so intuitively, I tried to dig an edge in, and then that was the end of the program. I just went down and just went down to the bottom of the mountain. It's counterintuitive, but your skiers aren't really digging those edges in. They're pretty relaxed on this injected ice environment. Is that true?
They are. That's true. I mean, the skis are so sharp that as long as you there's a confidence factor. As long as you believe that they will hold you in your turn, they will. But you have a moment of doubt, you could instantly find yourself on your side sliding down the hill. So confidence and strength are enormous in that case. And, you have to keep in mind, too, that what you were doing at Wildcat in New Hampshire, perhaps you weren't tuning your skis every single night, which is what's happening at the world class, even the club-based level in Park City and elsewhere around the country. They're often tuning, sharpening, and adjusting their edges every single day.
Yeah, it's just fascinating. Let's talk about coaching. How has coaching changed since you competed in 84 in Sarajevo?
Well, quite a lot. I mean, the beauty of this, too, is there's both, you know, coaching specifically for the sport and then coaching in general for athletics. So think of, you know, a lot of the sports psychology part of it. There's things that are true of a gymnast, that are true of a ski racer, that are true of a free skier in terms of how do you focus, how do you block out, how do you put the bad thoughts out of your mind, or in terms of golf, you know, have a good thoughts in your golf swing, not bad thoughts in your golf swing. And then there's the very endemic part. So again, coaches have refined their techniques of how to help the athletes understand how to adjust what they do the next time they go and take a run, you know, which is typically minutes later. So it's this deliberate practice and understanding how important that is. And coaches' education. So at the younger ages, it's so important to have great coaches in the field, and there are many of them, and they have a great sport education system that we run and support in our sport that helps disseminate the latest, greatest, bleeding edge information about how you do it, whatever it is in each sport. Body position in space is paramount in all of our sports. And so having a coach also that has the right video resources and metrics, like I was mentioning, so that the athlete knows what to work on. Because when you're executing deliberate practice, you can only think of one thing. You go take another run or another jump, there's only one thing you can work on at that moment. Yeah. It's got to be the most important thing. And so that's gotten much better over the years.
Tiger Shaw, the CEO of U.S. Ski and Snowboard, thanks so much for joining us today, Tiger. We'll have you back and talk about more of these interesting topics.
Thank you much. Have a great day.
Thanks, Tiger.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening, and hey, tune in next week.